Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory. Welcome to Backstory. I'm Brian Ballow. If you're new to the podcast, we're all historians, and each week, along with my colleagues Joanne Freeman, Ed Ayers, and Nathan Connolly, we explore a different aspect of American history. Today on the show, we're bringing you a compilation of past segments in celebration of March as Women's History Month. With over 100 women serving in Congress and already a record number of women announcing their 2020 presidential candidacy, this year marks the strongest female presence in American political history. But for most of American history, of course, the U.S. government was almost exclusively male. That is, until Margaret Chase Smith, a Republican senator from Maine, ran for president in 1964 and made it all the way to the party's convention. A few years back, the podcast Radio Diaries ran this piece about her campaign, the farthest any woman had gotten in major party politics up to that point.
There are those who make the contention that no woman should ever dare to aspire to the White House, that this is a man's world, and that it should be kept that way.
My name is Janann Sherman, and I wrote the book No Place for a Woman, A Life of Senator Margaret Chase Smith.
My name is Merton Henry, and in 1964, I worked on the Margaret Chase Smith presidential campaign.
Margaret Chase Smith was born in a little town in central Maine called Skowhegan. Her mother struggled working in the shoe factory, working as a waitress and so forth. So it was not an easy life. And I think that was the basis for a lot of Margaret's ambition, that she didn't want to end up like her mother had. She had better ideas for herself.
She was the first woman ever elected to the Senate in her own right. She was very much a middle-of-the-road Republican who really followed her own instincts on things.
She definitely was seen by 1964 as a hawk.
It does not pay to play footsie with the communists.
She was probably the only woman in 1964 that had the stature to be a serious candidate for president.
It is contended that I should not run for president because the odds are too heavily against me for even the most remote chance of victory.
In January 1964, Margaret Chase Smith was scheduled to make a regular speech to the Women's Press Club.
Third, it is contended that as a woman, I would not have the physical stamina and strength to run. So because of these very impelling reasons against my running, I have decided that I shall.
So that was the opening shot.
Senator Margaret Chase Smith of Maine, the first woman to announce a serious bid for the White House, who will enter the New Hampshire presidential primary on March 10th.
All out for Margaret, the senator from the wonderful state of Maine.
She campaigned in Illinois, she campaigned some in Oregon. She campaigned in small towns before Rotary clubs. She drove both places by car.
She would not accept campaign contributions, so she had no money, no poll workers, no buttons, no bumper stickers. Goldwater and Rockefeller, her opponents, were both millionaires. So I think she decided to take the moral high ground by saying, you don't have to be a millionaire to be president of the United States.
From Washington, D.C., Senator Margaret Chase Smith, Republican of Maine, will face the nation.
She tried to get people to pay attention to her record, what she had done of substance, not the fact that she was a woman. But, of course, she was constantly asked that. I mean, it's the very first thing that people see.
Senator Smith, not all countries have the same attitudes towards women as the United States. How do you think a woman president of the United States would make out in international conferences and those so-called nose-to-nose meetings?
Well, I would remind you that once there was Catherine the Great. I would remind you that there was Queen Victoria. I would also call your attention to Mr. Khrushchev's references to me through the years, when he called me an Amazon warmonger hiding behind a rose.
Well, how do you think you would make out in a kitchen confrontation with Mr. Khrushchev?
Well, I wouldn't care to estimate that. If it was making blueberry muffins, I probably would win.
We are well aware of that, Senator, from having sampled them.
She was always having to walk that tightrope between being strong enough and tough enough to be commander-in-chief, to run a country, but still feminine enough and ladylike enough, because being feminine was absolutely essential. And so she tried to balance it the best way she knew how.
Leave it to the girl where there's a thrill.
She was always meticulously dressed. She was very careful about her appearance and everything.
She would tell Time magazine that nothing clears her mind like vacuuming, or pose with a mixing bowl, or primping in a mirror. That was a favorite. Senator Smith had a campaign song called Leave It to the Girls.
We'll wear perfume and pearls, be diplomatic in pink curls.
The response from the press was not pretty. One of the pundits said that a woman could be president just as long as she didn't act like one. The press never treated her as if she had a realistic shot at it.
Good afternoon. This is the Republican National Convention at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. Before this day is out, the nominee of the Republican Party will have been determined.
I am now proud and honored to nominate the senior senator from the great Republican state of Maine, Senator Margaret Chase Smith.
You know, she knew at that point that she was not going to get the nomination, to say the least. Goldwater had the nomination pretty much sewed up.
And there it is. Senator Barry Goldwater is the Republican Party's nominee for the presidency of the United States.
The standard is, if you're the loser and you don't have enough delegates to swing it, well, then you very graciously release your delegates to vote for other candidates. But Senator Smith never released them. And the total of the 27 votes that she got on the floor, she hung on to, denying Barry Goldwater the unanimous vote for the nomination. So she came in second.
The tumult and the shouting has died. Senator Margaret Chase Smith, the lady from Maine, has emerged from her precedent-breaking bid for the presidency with even greater stature and reputation. Let's get around to this. You made some history, lovely lady, in being the first woman ever nominated.
Yes, it's quite a satisfaction today to think about.
Why do it at all? People run because they want to prove a point. They run because they want to make a statement. They run because they've got an oversized ego or something. There are all sorts of reasons that people run for president, even though they may know they have little chance of winning. Her reason was to prove that a woman could be a serious presidential candidate. And she did. She proved it.
Will we see a woman elected president of the United States during our lifetime? Perhaps not so wild a dream. The world is changing rapidly. Politics change with it. Many of the once impossible things have happened. Time alone will tell if a woman will someday break the tradition that only men can hold that office.
That piece was produced by Joe Richman and Samara Freemark. It came to us from the podcast Radio Diaries as part of the Contender series, profiles of the most original presidential candidates who never won the White House. To hear more of these profiles, head to radiodiaries.org. On Mother's Day in 1970, female African-American telephone operators in New York City suddenly walked off the job and went on strike. It was the busiest phone day of the year, and it made quite an impression on young feminist activist Gay Semmel. Fresh out of college, Gay decided to apply for a job as an operator at New York Telephone. She hoped to help fellow operators unionize under the Communication Workers of America. Switchboard operators had some of the most stressful jobs of anyone in the telephone company at the time. Their hours weren't standardized. They sat at huge boards, plugging cables into holes for hours. And while they were doing that, managers stalked behind them, reprimanding them for not working fast enough or not sitting up straight enough. Managers could listen in on operators at any time and discipline them for not following their scripts. The company had a very specific idea about who was supposed to do these jobs. And when I spoke to Gay back in 2015, she said she didn't exactly fit that bill. After she left the phone company, Gay Semmel became a union side labor lawyer. I spoke to her in 2015 on the first day of her retirement after working for the Communication Workers of America for almost 30 years.
When I applied for the job, I did not tell them I'd gone to college. If I had done that, I never would have gotten the job. And I was one of, in my building, in terms of cordboard operators, there was only three white women. Everyone else was black. And
how many is everyone else?
Hundreds.
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 So this is a colossal board, three white women, hundreds of African-American women, no men at all?
No men.
Why did just women do this job?
That is a very important question. At that time, every single job was designated by gender and race. So all telephone operators were women. All technicians were male. Black men got hired to work on the frame. White men got hired to work as installers and switch people.
What about the actual working conditions having to do with gender and sexual discrimination? What kinds of barriers did women face when they went in to work each day?
All right, so when you were interviewed for the job, they literally asked the women, certainly the operators, what your menstrual cycle was. And I was sort of shocked by that. And I said, why would you want to know that? And they said, well, you know, the phone service is an essential service and we have to have a reliable workforce. And so we want to make sure that if people are out because they have menstrual cramps, it's in their cycle. That was like so shocking to me that they would keep a record of what your menstrual cycle was so that you couldn't, you know, pretend that you had menstrual cramps on a different day.
Given that, Gay, one wonders why they hired women at all.
Probably because women were paid a lot less than the men.
I think that might be the reason.
And they couldn't get men to have worked for that kind of pay. The other thing that they did when they hired you, if you had children, you had to tell them who would take care of your children if they got sick. In other words, that you wouldn't stay home to take your kids if you got sick. And then you had to have a backup. Who would take care of your children if they were sick and the caregiver was sick?
That's incredible. So that was part of simply the routine interview, is providing all that information.
Exactly. They treated the women like they were children. There were these ridiculous posters everywhere about being on time with little cartoon characters. You went to operator school before you became an operator.
Tell me about that.
You went to operator school for 2 weeks because you had to learn how to use the cord board. You had to learn the little scripts of what you would say. And when you finished operator school, you got a pink certificate. And then you got a little charm bracelet with a telephone directory on the charm. It was ridiculous.
Something tells me you were not charmed.
I wasn't charmed. No, I wasn't charmed.
We both speculated that the company hired women precisely because they could pay them less.
Absolutely.
And you were actually involved in a landmark case that challenged both pay and discrimination against women. There was a very famous settlement, $38 million, and
right.
AT&T agreed to end discrimination in salaries. Did you realize any immediate benefits from that?
No, and I didn't. I only stayed there 2 years. And right after the consent decree, which was the resolution of that lawsuit, the phone company created a whole new series of ways to make it very difficult for women in particular to get into these technician jobs. So when you applied for a job, or more likely, you applied for a transfer, you were an operator and you wanted to, you know, become a installation person or a switch person, and you applied, well, other people were applying as well. And so there were these adders that gave men a boost. So the adders were previous experience, things like, you know, technical knowledge. So it was very hard for women to compete because they came from operator jobs. They didn't have prior experience. They didn't have the technical knowledge, right, et cetera. So it took a long time.
One of our favorite stories at Backstory is about a prominent Black female activist and journalist, brought to us in 2018 by my colleague Nathan Conley. It starts off on a sunny Tennessee day in September of 1883, when a young African-American schoolteacher named Ida B. Wells boarded a train in Memphis. Historian Paula Giddings picks up the story.
The trains were very important to African Americans in this period of what it represents. I mean, the trains are bringing communities together. They're going, you know, transcontinentally at this point. And Blacks saw this as a very important emblem of what of their first class citizenship.
Remember, this is less than 20 years after the Civil War. Blacks across the South are trying to claim the rights that have been promised to them after emancipation. And train travel, believe it or not, was a major battleground in the late 19th century. One of the ways African Americans expressed their rights is to buy a first-class ticket. And that's what Ida B. Wells was doing on that September day in 1883. I mean, picture it. She has a parasol, she's wearing long white gloves, she's wearing a long, full-length dress, corseted at the waist. She's the picture of respectability.
She goes into the first-class colored car, but she sees that people are smoking there. And there was even a white man who was drunk there.
And Wells was hearing none of it. She decided it was better off for her to go to the ladies' car, where those who could travel quietly and with a sense of class, basically, found their seat.
Okay, so Nathan, she leaves the first-class colored car, as they would have put it, because it was rowdy and smoky?
Yeah, I mean, she felt she had the right to sit in first-class accommodations because she bought a first-class ticket. So she leaves the first-class colored car and moves to the first-class ladies' car, where she had sat before. It was mostly full of white women. That decision to enter the women's car would propel Ida B. Wells onto a new path, one that would make her a household name in America.
I regret to inform you, ma'am, but I cannot accept your ticket in this car.
The conductor, William Murray, when he asked for her ticket about a mile into the trip, determined that she was not indeed a lady. She couldn't sit in the ladies' car.
Did he say that to her? I mean, did he say, you are not a lady?
He basically said that she should be in the colored car.
Conductor asked her to leave. She refused to move.
I'm sorry. I intend to ride, right?
There were efforts to get her out of the car.
She first said no verbally. Then he put his hands on her, actually grabbed her by the arm and tugged her so hard that it tore the sleeve on her dress. Wells, in response, latched her feet beneath the seat in front of her.
Then, wow.
then decided to take a bite out of the conductor's hand and drew blood. She scratched him with nails.
Until finally she was actually physically extricated.
Took two or three extra people to basically forcibly drag Wells from the ladies' car to the colored-only car.
But here's a question. What are the other ladies in the car doing?
Believe it or not, Joanne, they were actually cheering. And not cheering for Wells, but cheering for the conductors who were dragging Ida Wells out of the ladies' car and back to the colored-only car.
Wow.
Here's how Wells described it later.
Some of them even stood on the seats so that they could get a good view and continued applauding the conductor for his brave stand.
Nathan, this is an incredibly compelling story, but is this the train to nowhere? I don't really understand where advocacy journalism is coming up along the track here.
Well, a few things come out of this incident. First, and importantly, Wells sues the train company and wins, though it's later overturned on appeal. Secondly,
Wells is asked to write about her experience.
Which she does, in a local Black paper called The Living Way. Her story gets a big response from Black readers, and she decides to give up teaching and become a journalist full-time. She moves from her own story to describe and document the experiences of Black citizens across the Jim Crow South.
And she would later say that in journalism, I found the real me. This was the beginning of that career and of her really pursuing the craft to express herself.
So, Nathan, it sounds like Ida Wells found her voice and she's found what she wants to do with that voice.
That's right, Joanne. But before we get into her story, let's describe what journalism looked like in the late 19th century. It was, you could say, an industry in flux.
So in the 1880s, there were a bunch of fairly boring newspapers. They were very text-based.
This is media historian David Mindich. He says there were elite newspapers, such as the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune, that covered business and stocks and had been around for decades. But they were also losing readers to a new breed of newspapers like the New York World and the New York Journal. These upstarts were published by Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst.
Pulitzer and Hearst really introduced street life and street reporting and women's news and celebrity news to the news universe of the late 1880s and 1890s.
And these papers are using sensational headlines, they're using very shaky research methods, and they're finding ways to gobble up as much readership as possible. You might recognize it.
Reality TV.
Or at the time, yellow journalism, right, to use that term.
And reporting became more exciting. They're completely blowing over their rivals, the elite newspapers. And so the elite newspapers had to make a decision. Were they going to join them in their sensationalism, or were they just going to try to ridicule them? And they chose the second. Notably, the New York Times called it not only yellow journalism, but freak journalism.
Mindich says that the older establishment papers also trumpeted the concept of objectivity. It became the new standard. A hallmark of objective reporting was its dispassionate tone.
Try to cover the world in a very serious way, balanced, fair, conservative-minded in their reporting, and restrained in their language.
A sense of detachment. You want reporters who can take themselves out of the story and seemingly give all sides of an event. And what we assume to simply be a timeless value in journalism is really a way for papers like the New York Times to get a larger slice of the market share. That strategy didn't quite boost circulation, but it did solidify the reputation of the New York Times as the paper of record. In contrast to those working class rags, the New York Times proclaimed its paper, quote, does not soil the breakfast cloth, unquote. So that's the white press, the mainstream. But in the world of 19th century journalism, there's another player, the Black press. There were scores of small, independently owned Black newspapers across the country. Ida B. Wells made a name for herself in the Black press. Historian Paula Gittings says that by the time she was 30 years old, Wells already co-owned a newspaper in Memphis, and her articles were being reprinted throughout the country.
She's called the Princess of the Press. And she's written a lot, and she's really hailed, and people like her writing. She's one of the few women, in fact, one of the few journalists that both women and men seem to read equally.
Wells wrote about the countless challenges that Black Americans were facing after the Civil War. I mean, you had systematic disenfranchisement, you had Jim Crow laws, you had debt peonage, and of course, the most terrifying trend of all, lynching.
There's genocidal threats. If you hear and read even in the newspapers, the threats of the need to have to wipe out the evil of Blacks.
Lynchings and other terror attacks on African Americans spiked in the 1880s and 1890s. Now, the white press covered some of these crimes, but most of the coverage followed a pretty standard script. You had an African-American man who commits some crime, usually a rape, and the white masses seek vigilante justice through some kind of violence. Now, implicit in this narrative was the belief among white Americans that blacks simply weren't ready for freedom. You had scientific journals that cited poverty rates as if somehow blacks had regressed in the late 19th century. You had notions of political power that were given too soon to black people, and Reconstruction was a failure in that respect. The idea, of course, was that you had to control blacks from their otherwise primal state.
Again, to rationalize lynching, right, which was to protect white womanhood from what they said was the new Negro crime, which was the rape of white women all across the South.
So the Northern elite newspapers covered lynching with appropriate disgust in that, you know, most of the articles were horrified by the practice of lynching. However, they balanced that disgust with a sense that African Americans were committing crimes.
In other words, Northerners never questioned the guilt of the victims. They just thought the criminal should be tried or convicted in a court of law instead of lynched by a mob. Then, in 1892, there were three men lynched in Memphis, Tennessee, and they happened to be friends of Ida B. Wells. Here's what happened. A black businessman named Thomas Moss owned a grocery store in Memphis. Two of his friends worked for him. His main business competitor was a white grocer.
Who was in the same area.
Who was in the black neighborhood, right?
Yes, it was a neighborhood that was changing. You know, the South wasn't segregated until really relatively late. But this was a area that had been white, was beginning to change towards blacks, but it was still a mixed neighborhood at this point.
But the problem is that when you compete in these small communities, it can create these moments of friction.
And there is an incident.
Two teenage boys got into a fistfight in front of the Moss grocery store. Older men of both races jumped in to break it up, but the fight escalated and turned into a small race riot. Remember that white grocer down the road? He smelled an opportunity.
The white proprietor says that the real provocateurs of this riot were the men of the People's Grocery, who included Thomas Moss and two other men.
They decided to attack the grocery store. Moss and McDowell and Stewart took up arms and defended themselves against what ultimately became a band of white men armed who came to the establishment. There was a gunfight, and shortly thereafter, the three men were lynched in pretty methodical fashion.
It was a horrible, torturous lynching, and the reason why we know all these gory details is because the white press had actually been told in advance that the lynching was going to take place and where it was going to take place.
The local white papers portrayed Moss as a rioter and a killer. Months later, another newspaper accused him of being a rapist. And how did those local white papers cover the lynching itself? Well, one adopted a high-minded, even reverential tone.
There is no whooping, not even loud talking, no cursing, in fact, nothing boisterous. Everything was done decently and in order. The vengeance was sharp, swift, and sure, but administered with due regard to the fact that people were asleep all around the jail.
Wells happened to be out of town when the lynching occurred, and when she got home, she began to piece together the real story. She realized that the kindling that ignited the riot, the gunfight, the lynching, was all a cover. The white grocer down the road simply wanted to put Moss out of business.
This lynching was to be a lesson to blacks who deigned to succeed and to emerge and to compete with whites and to fight back.
And it really did kind of fix in her mind that the kinds of things that were happening to black people across the South couldn't all be traced back to some narrative about the evil black male rapist or sexual predator, but that there were economic issues that could also be at the base of racial violence.
So she begins to think about lynching anew. If Thomas Moss was guilty of nothing but competing with white people, what is happening with all these other lynchings that I'm reading about?
Wells began traveling across the South to do her own investigations of lynchings. I mean, think about it. No one else in the white press was even trying to get the facts. But Ida B. Wells, she was fearless.
And so she goes to actual scenes of the crime.
She actually goes to the scenes. She documents everything.
Imagine, you know, someone who's literally, you know, trouncing around in the woods, right, investigating the marks under a lynching tree.
She interviews witnesses.
Investigative journalism being carried out by a woman of color, oftentimes in at night or, you know, under some kind of, you know, false story to kind of get her access to certain people.
The other thing Wells did, by the way, was to send private investigators to some of these lynchings. White investigators, in fact, who reported back to her.
She also poured through data in establishment papers and, really like a sociologist, began to notice certain patterns. Eventually, she reached some explosive conclusions.
She shows that, the majority, the great majority of blacks weren't even accused of rape, much less guilty of it.
When it was charged, rape was charged only after the lynching.
Wow.
She began to systematically unpack and refute the lie that African Americans were lawless.
Wells printed her conclusions in an unsigned editorial in her newspaper.
Nobody in this section believes the old threadbare lie that Negro men assault white women. If Southern white men are not careful, they will overreach themselves, and a conclusion will be reached which will be very damaging to the moral reputation of their women.
Soon after she published that editorial, a white mob destroyed her printing press in Memphis. They chased her partners out of town, and she fled too. Wells went to New York and published an anti-lynching pamphlet called Southern Horrors. She was invited then to speak to audiences across the U.S. and Britain, and she helped make lynching an international scandal.
Now, somehow, Nathan, I don't think you're going to tell me at this point that those big establishment papers rushed to hire Ida Wells.
I will not tell you that. Let Mindich tell it.
And the New York Times called her a nasty-minded mulattress and called on sober Americans to repudiate her.
Remember how those major papers of the day prided themselves on their objectivity? Well, Wells's reporting on lynching actually demolished a lot of that, because for all of their devotion to balance, it never occurred to the big presses to question the guilt of the lynching victims. So, in effect, they missed the real story.
Nathan, I'm confused. I mean, here's this woman trudging through dangerous landscape to collect facts, to find evidence. How is it that these so-called objective New York Times can critique that?
Well, when you have a press room that has all white men, and you don't have a set of, you know, diverse perspectives about something as, you know, simple as whether or not a crime was committed, it really leaves you out of position when somebody else comes on the scene with, you know, new evidence.
So her advocacy what made her more objective.
It didn't necessarily make her more objective, but it made her more effective. And that I think, is a very important distinction, right? If objectivity is thought of as being the gold standard in this period, and there's a way in which, you know, a kind of perceived or projected distance from the issues somehow made the account more true. What Ida B. Wells basically showed is that by caring enough to put, again, feet on the ground, to ask the questions, to find ways to get to the bottom of things, because, frankly, she cared about black life, she ended up writing better journalism, right? It wasn't that it was necessarily
more objective journalism, you might say.
Well, it wasn't emotionally distant. It was more accurate, yeah.
But it was a journalism that put a whole set of facts.
I was about to use the word fact. I was going to say, so they don't like her facts, so they attack her motives.
The New York Times was often using the same criticisms of Wells that it used against Pulitzer and Hearst for being kind of sensational journalists. And it's almost as if white reporters couldn't fathom that African Americans were being terrorized by whites in the South. I mean, that probably would go against their concept of America as being a fair country.
So, Nathan, I have a question. I'm actually curious. How much did Wells' work actually change the myths that were circulating about lynching?
Well, according to David Mindich, it took the white mainstream press decades to get around to recognizing Wells' investigative work. Black Americans, as a point of contrast, recognized almost immediately that what Wells was doing was digging up the truth.
Frederick Douglass said to Ida B. Wells, you know, until I read your reporting, I had thought that African-American crimes contributed to lynching. And so, you know, if Frederick Douglass, you know, arguably the leading 19th century civil rights figure, had bought into these lies, you know that this was a widespread, pervasive belief that just basically everyone believed.
Ida B. Wells was restoring reputations, and in many cases, she vindicated African Americans who had not only been murdered, but who had been dishonored by false accusations.
She also preserved their deaths for our historical record.
My name is Lisa Lenore, and I am an ancestor of one of the men listed in Ida B. Wells' work on lynching.
Wells reported that Samuel Woods, Lenore's great-great-grandfather, had been lynched, quote, without reason.
I think that when people see names in the paper, they just think, oh, it's someone's name. But they don't realize that there's families that are attached to these names and hopes and dreams and, you know, so many aspirations. So when she put that in this document, that was so powerful for us as a family to really reconnect with this portion of our history that we did not know about because it was so painful. It was in the background, but to have it documented just really elevated it even more so for me.
Lenore, a former reporter, says that she draws inspiration from Wells as an investigative journalist.
It's really a twin legacy. Wells was a pioneer of investigative and advocacy journalism.
Well, one of her phrases was, she said, the people must know before they can act.
Hmm.
And so what her overarching objective was always to inform people about what was happening in a way that would help them to act.
Paula Giddings is a historian at Smith College and author of Ida, A Sword Among Lions.
David Mindich also helped tell that story. He's a professor of media studies and journalism at St. Michael's College in Colchester, Vermont, and the author of Just the Facts, How Objectivity Came to Define American Journalism.
You'll find our complete Backstory archive with hundreds of stories and discussions at backstoryradio.org. Funding from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation is helping Virginia Humanities and Backstory change the narrative of race and representation. Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Provost's Office at the University of Virginia, the Johns Hopkins University, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.